Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former U.S. prosecutor and author Elizabeth de la Vega, who explains how she believes the case against Bush administration officials who authorized torture should proceed. Joe Comerford, executive director of the National Priorities Project, who talks about President Obama's shift in war spending from Iraq to Afghanistan and the continued growth of military spending overall. And Josh Stearns, with the media reform group Free Press, who discusses some of the causes behind the U.S. newspaper crisis and proposed strategies to ensure the survival of local journalism. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Sri Lanka has apparently inflicted a fatal blow to the Tamil Tigers rebel movement, which saw their 26-year insurgency collapse on a beach in northeast Sri Lanka on Monday, May 11th. The BBC reported that Tamil Tiger military leader Vilopalai Prabhakaran and his top aides were killed by Sri Lankan troops as they attempted to flee the war zone in an ambulance. Prabhakaran oversaw the Tamil insurgency since the early 1980s, as the Tamil Tigers became one of the most violent and feared guerrilla movements in the world. At one point, the Tamil Tigers controlled one-third of the island nation, but its rule crumbled in recent months under fire during a government offensive. The Tigers often used suicide bombing and assassinated Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi in 1991. In recent weeks, remnants of the Tamil rebel force were boxed in on a sliver of beach in northeast Sri Lanka. The army pressed hard against the Tigers and ignored Western calls for a ceasefire. Human rights groups accused the Sri Lankan army of committing war crimes for shelling several civilian hospitals during its offensive. During peace talks in 2002, the Tamils were offered regional autonomy, but not independence. The Tamils' military leader rejected the peace offer. Since late January this year, over 7,000 Tamil civilians have died in the war zone during the army offensive. The body count exceeds all the casualties for 2009 in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Gaza combined. Burma's pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi has gone on trial for violating the rules of her detention. Suu Kyi, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, has spent 13 of the last 19 years under house arrest. Her detention was set to end on May 27th. Suu Kyi faces a 5-year sentence for allegedly allowing American John Yetaw into her house. Yetaw swam across a lake unannounced to meet with Suu Kyi for a paper he was writing. Human rights activists say the junta that runs Myanmar is pressing charges to keep Suu Kyi in detention during next year's scheduled elections. The secretive Southeast Asian nation has been run by the military since the 1960s. In the last election in 1990, Suu Kyi's party, the National League of Democracy, won a majority of seats but were prevented from taking power. Western governments, including the United States, Britain, and the European Union, have called for Myanmar's generals to release Suu Kyi. On the first day of the trial, the judge rejected a motion to open the proceedings to the public. Philippine Foreign Minister Alberto Romulo condemned Suu Kyi's arrest and expressed outrage about the trumped-up charges against the democracy activist. Yet Myanmar's top trading partners, India and China, have remained silent about the case. Chemical giant W.R. Grace was acquitted by a federal jury of knowingly exposing residents of Libby, Montana, to asbestos poisoning. The not guilty verdict was a blow to federal prosecutors who pressed a complex case against W.R. Grace, a company implicated in other toxic hotspots like Love Canal in upstate New York. Federal Judge Donald Malloy blasted prosecutors for relying on a company whistleblower who was not seen as a credible witness and for withholding information. According to the Los Angeles Times, over 1,200 people in Libby, a small mining town, have died or become sick from asbestos-related diseases. Grace operated a vermiculite mine in Libby from 1963 to 1990. Prosecutors were hampered in pressing criminal charges because the statute of limitations law prevents charges of negligence for pollution that occurred decades earlier. Instead, prosecutors tried to prove Grace executives knowingly contaminated Libby residents. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Ostowski.
Although President Obama has repeatedly stated his view that he'd rather look forward than backward with regard to the Bush administration's torture and abuse of U.S.-held detainees, the issue just won't go away. A steady stream of revelations about President Bush's torture program have trickled out since President Obama released the now infamous Bush Justice Department memos detailing the authorization of waterboarding and other harsh interrogation methods. Lawrence Wilkerson, Chief of Staff for former Secretary of State Colin Powell, wrote in the Washington Note, an online political journal, that the Bush administration's sanction of torture against key terrorist suspects was not aimed at preempting another terrorist attack on the U.S., but discovering a smoking gun linking Iraq and al-Qaeda. Meanwhile, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California, has become the focus of Republican efforts to distract the public from focusing on Bush administration culpability. Citing reports that the then House Minority Leader had been briefed early on about Bush administration torture of prisoners, Pelosi responded by accusing the CIA of misleading her and Congress about the specifics of administration torture policy. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Elizabeth de la Vega, a former federal prosecutor, who explains her belief that a rush to appoint a special prosecutor could weaken the case against Bush administration officials who violated international and U.S. law by authorizing torture.
I don't have any reason to believe that the appointment of a special prosecutor is in the works. I don't think it is. But I think it's important for people to understand, first of all, that there really is no such thing as a special prosecutor. The law that we have right now is a set of regulations, and under those regulations, a person could be appointed as a special counsel from outside the department. But once that happens, that person would actually be reporting just as any other prosecutor would be, more or less, within the Department of Justice. So ultimately, that person would be reporting to Obama. To Eric Holder, excuse me. And so from the point of view of people who don't trust the current administration to handle this properly, the special counsel doesn't solve that problem. So whether you're coming at that point of view from the right or the left, it's really an illusion to think that there's such a thing as an outside prosecutor. So that's one half of the problem that I have with it. The other half is that as soon as any criminal investigation is opened, that provides everybody who wants to avoid talking about this with a ready excuse to say, no, we can't comment, we can't have any public hearings because there's this criminal investigation going on. And we've seen that happen actually a number of times. It's going on right now with the investigation into the destruction of the CIA tapes. It's going on with the investigation into the U.S. attorney firings, and that's exactly what happened when Patrick Fitzgerald was appointed with the CIA leak. In fact, I think that's a good reason, one of the things that contributed to Bush being reelected. He didn't have to talk about that throughout 2003-2004. So my overall point is that I don't think appointing a special prosecutor really has any beneficial effects, and I think it has a number of negative effects, because what we want, what I think needs to happen right now is more public information and a presentation that's somewhat organized, and I do think that we need some kind of commission in order to do that.
There are those advocates of prosecution who have raised the alarm about a statute of limitations that may bury the possibility of any prosecutions going forward if it is not done within the next year or two. And I know you've responded to that, but tell our listeners your view on statute of limitations and how that would affect any prosecution over torture.
Well, it's not really so much my view. It's actually what the law says. The statute of limitations for torture says that there's an 8-year period unless the torture either actually caused death or created a serious risk, a foreseeable risk of death or bodily injury, in which case there is no statute of limitations period. It's indefinite. So considering that we have a series of acts of torture over several years, at least 8 of which we know caused death, and probably dozens of which clearly created a serious risk of death or at least serious bodily injury, I don't think we have a problem with the statute of limitations. On top of that, any time you charge a conspiracy, the statute doesn't start to run until the conspiracy is over. And based on my knowledge of conspiracy, it's very clear to me that this conspiracy did not end basically until the administration left.
Now, do you think that is some kind of prosecution will grow out of a truth commission? Because often you have instances where immunity is granted and things are swept under the rug. Often these commissions appear to many to be a whitewash, a easy way out for both of the major political parties in the country to just sort of put the sticky business behind them.
Well, with regard to the concept of a whitewash, to me, the most important aspect of a public commission is the evidence that is presented for the general public. Their conclusions actually really don't make much difference to me at all. What I hope to achieve, what I would want to see achieved, is the revelation of all this information in a way that people can understand. When we have these congressional hearings, you have this crazy, fragmented little blips of evidence coming out interspersed with statements by congresspeople that are self-serving. So it's pretty much useless. And a commission can address that and bring out the evidence in an orderly fashion. And that, to me, is the key thing that we need. And in terms of immunity, it just has to be addressed in a rational way. There, not every single person involved in this entire operation would be somebody who needs to be charged. There's hundreds of people who are involved, and people have different levels of culpability, just as they would in any criminal operation. So my recommendation, to the extent anybody would be listening, would be none of the people who are the major targets or even subjects should be given immunity at all. If George W. Bush wants to testify at this commission, fine. But a case is made against a criminal defendant by putting out the evidence all around him. You don't make a case by calling the defendant. You make a case through witnesses who know what happened. And that's what needs to occur here.
That was former federal prosecutor Elizabeth de la Vega, author of the book United States versus George W. Bush et al. Read her articles online at truthout.org. U.S. funding for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan has totaled $830 billion to date. Last week, President Obama released his first budget, and some progressive activists, especially anti-war activists, were dismayed that the $84 billion he requested for those two wars was in a supplemental request, not part of the regular Defense Department budget. But it turns out that this was a transitional budget from the former Bush administration to the incoming Obama team, and that's why current war spending is still off the books. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Joe Comerford, executive director of the National Priorities Project, about President Obama's shift in spending from Iraq to Afghanistan and the continued growth of military spending under the new administration. She also described some of the human needs that could be met if funding were to be shifted from war spending to domestic programs.
President Obama did make the promise that he was going to core fund, he called it core funding, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq toward the end of transparency, as he promised. It's important to remember, though, that this supplemental that Congress voted on last week, so the House, and the Senate is due to vote on this week, this supplemental is a leftover, if you will, from the Bush years. So the war to date has been funded in two supplemental packages, one for the front end, one for the back end of each fiscal year. So this was the back end funding for 2009 for the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The original number was 83.4. That's what President Obama asked for, $83.4 billion. What the House voted on, though, was something much more significant than that, which was $96.7 billion in emergency war appropriations. And so that gives us some concern on a number of levels, one of which is, of course, that military spending in the United States is, although slowed under President Obama in fiscal year 2010, still consumes an enormous portion of the federal budget, more than 20% actually of discretionary and mandatory spending. Mandatory is stuff that doesn't require a vote of Congress. It's the stuff that we have made a commitment to as a nation, like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and some portions of military, interest on the debt and things like that. And then discretionary is the stuff that Congress votes on to put into being.
So in his own upcoming budget, Obama has included war spending in his regular budget request, as he promised he would?
In fiscal year 2010, President Obama has included $130 billion in his proposed budget for this fiscal year, this coming one, which begins October 1, 2009, and will run through the fiscal year of 2010. He's included $130 billion in spending for the U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So when we do the president's budget for next year, it will include that money. So there's good things and there's bad things, right? So President Obama has made that promise, and he's doing it. So this year, the proposed fiscal year 2010 budget, which we just released, has military spending, a big chunk of money for military spending at $704 billion. So that's an enormous chunk of money. And the war is core funded, and we'll see it there, and we're going to stop having these supplementals. One of the issues, though, is that military spending is not reversing a trend. It's slowing a growth trend, but not reversing a trend. So with the Obama administration declaring that it's going to expand the U.S. war in Afghanistan, for example, war spending is starting to shift. So we used to see war spending at about 80% for Iraq, 20% for Afghanistan. Now we're seeing about 70% for Iraq and 30% for Afghanistan. So we're seeing more money for Afghanistan take up more of the war spending pie.
Presumably, Joe Comerford, as things wind down more in Iraq, U.S. spending will go down even more, and spending in Afghanistan will go up.
Exactly.
But in the next year and the year after that, do you think, will the absolute dollars for Afghanistan keep going up and the absolute dollars for Iraq keep going down?
That's the concern. I mean, the concern is that the Afghanistan dollars are going to continue going up. We, of course, applaud. As National Priorities Project, we've been concerned about runaway military spending, so we applaud the decrease in dollars going to Iraq, but are concerned that we're really going to see some repeat performance of this hemorrhage of spending for Afghanistan, and thus we're not getting ourselves away from the problem that we've had.
One of the things that National Priorities Project is best known for is talking about priorities. So can you give an example, say, in California, of what other kinds of spending could be increased if the military budget were to be cut?
Sure. In California, $9.8 billion, this is just for the supplemental, it's not for the war costs to date, about 4 million people could have had health insurance for 1 year, or 17 million homes could have been fitted with renewable electricity, or 1.8 million students could have gotten the maximum Pell Grant for 1 year. So one of the things that we try to do is get the numbers as local as possible and then trade them off against things so that folks can understand both the local impact and the magnitude of the number.
That was Joe Comerford, Executive Director of the National Priorities Project. Contact the project by calling area code 413-584-9556 or visit their website at nationalpriorities.org to find out what programs your tax dollars fund and the education, health, or environmental priorities that could be met if military spending were reduced. As the global financial crisis took its toll on all parts of the U.S. economy, many American newspapers found themselves on the brink of economic disaster. Some longtime journals have died, such as Denver's Rocky Mountain News. Others, like the Christian Science Monitor and Seattle Post-Intelligencer, have ended print publication and moved to online editions. The Tribune Company, owner of the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times, along with the publishers of the Philadelphia Inquirer and the New Haven Register, have declared bankruptcy. The Detroit News and Detroit Free Press have cut back home delivery from 7 to 3 days a week, while the Boston Globe and the New York Times are in financial distress. The media reform group Free Press recently released a report on the newspaper crisis titled Saving the News Toward a National Journalism Strategy. The study analyzes the economic and technological changes contributing to the decline of the traditional newspaper business model and proposes strategies to ensure the survival of local journalism. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Josh Stearns, program manager with Free Press, who co-authored the report. He summarizes Saving the News and its recommendations for changes in ownership structure, tax incentives, journalistic training, and investments in experimental models and public media.
There's really a sort of a perfect storm happening in the newspaper industry. A combination of things are coming together right now to put newspapers up against the ropes. So we're seeing a combination of things. We're seeing a growth of readership moving to the internet. We're seeing more and more people than ever reading the news now. The news is more popular than it has ever been, and people are seeking it out more than ever before, but they're seeking it out online. And so as eyeballs move from the printed page to the web page, we're seeing advertisers move online as well, and that's being complicated by the fact that many advertisers had already moved online to after things like Craigslist and other outlets where they could, you know, more cheaply or free post classified ads online. And as other advertisements moved online, it just hasn't made up the same revenue mix for newspapers. So we're seeing that happen, as well as this economic crisis that we're all facing has impacted newspapers' bottom line as well. So we're seeing a number of things kind of coming together at once. It's being compounded by the fact that newspapers have, for a really long time, not adapted well to their new digital era and have made a lot of decisions, including consolidation. The Tribune Company is a great example of that, buying up media properties all over the country and putting themselves in great debt to do so, so that now, even when papers at many of these companies are still profitable, they're not being able to increase profits the way that Wall Street would want them to, and they're really struggling to sort of meet their bottom line and pay off their debts that they've incurred.
So your report, titled Saving the News Toward a National Journalism Strategy, takes into account a whole lot of new ideas in terms of ownership models, tax incentives, training in journalism, and new models for public and community media. Maybe you could summarize the highlights of that report and what you think our listeners really need to know as they think about maybe their role as a citizen and you know, what happens next with newspapers, with digital publications, and really getting essential news out, which is the backbone of democracy.
Yeah, sure. I think one of the things that's really important to know is that this isn't a new discussion. A number of people, a number of organizations and foundations have been debating the future of news for quite some time now, but the piece that has been missing is a real in-depth discussion of what public policy might do to help save the news. And that's where we come in and what we bring to this discussion. So we're really interested in looking at a national journalism strategy which would involve public policy in putting journalists back to work and fostering a new news ecosystem that gets communities the information they need. A lot of people are really worried about government getting involved in journalism because of First Amendment questions and other concerns about how we're spending money right now in terms of the economic crisis. But I think it's important to know that there's a lot of models and a lot of policy options out there that we can implement that would definitely protect the First Amendment, that would produce quality coverage, that would provide adversarial perspectives and promote public accountability, that would hold our leaders, corporate and government leaders, accountable. In addition, though, we also have to prioritize innovation. I think that's a really important point. It's, as we look through these stories of newspapers folding, of more than 20,000 journalists losing their job in the last year and a half, what we hear a lot of is the doom and gloom of the newspaper industry. But right now, we're also at an incredible moment of rebirth, where we're seeing exciting new projects and initiatives being launched by working journalists, by entrepreneurial foundations, by nonprofit organizations, and others who are trying to find new ways of telling stories and getting communities the information they need. And we need to support that innovation, in part, we think, by investing in a sort of R&D fund for journalistic innovation. So we think that the same way that our government invests in medical research to heal the ails of the body, we should be investing in research and experimentation in journalism to heal the ails of the democracy. And we think that's a vital piece of one thing our government can do without impinging on any First Amendment rights, but can really sort of foster this new transition into a digital age. You mentioned new public media, new forms of public media. One of the things that we've seen is that NPR has invested deeply in the production of news, and their listenership has skyrocketed over the past 5 years. What we would like to see is all forms of non-commercial media get a booster shot in terms of federal funding and support so that non-commercial media can really begin to fill in the gap where our commercial media has failed us. That's 2 out of 5 of the things that we recommend in our report that I think are really important.
There's a vast class and racial and generational divide when it comes to who has access to digital media and digital news and information and commentary. What should the FCC, the government, and the corporate world be doing to provide what we hope to be near universal access so people can be consumers of this new digital media?
Well, we're seeing some really exciting first steps. President Obama made this a part of his platform from the early parts of his campaign, and in the stimulus bill that was passed, there was $7.2 billion for broadband deployment. So the administration is already moving forward with plans to begin to connect people who are underserved or unserved, which is a great first step. But even they admit that this first investment is just the beginning. So they've asked the Federal Communications Commission to create a national broadband strategy to be presented to Congress early next year. And the FCC is seeking comment on that right now so people can weigh in to tell the FCC what that national broadband strategy should look like. And one of the things we want to do is to make sure that people's voice is heard as part of that discussion. So people can go to www.freepress.net to join that discussion. We'll be having resources there within the next couple weeks to help people make their voice heard.
That was Josh Stearns, program manager with Free Press and co-author of the report, Saving the News, Toward a National Journalism Strategy. Contact Free Press by calling area code 202-265-1490 or visit their website at freepress.net, where you can download a copy of the report. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.